edition of World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C., and we're putting this program together in the wake of the Day of the Dupes. The Day of the Dupes, Tuesday, January 20th, 2009. The Day of the Dupes. The Triumph of Deception. And the inaugural address of Malaise. The Malaise, pioneered by Jimmy Carter, puppet of the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberger Group. That Malaise was dripping from the Obama inaugural, as one journalist at an ABC News online blog noted. This was Carter. This was a somewhat mildly veiled version of the infamous Carter-Malaise speech of July 1979. And it is a speech extremely ominous and extremely grim. The slogan is, "What is required of us now is a new era of responsibility." Don't look now. The new era of responsibility means a new era of austerity, of sacrifice, of cuts in the standard of living, a new era of genocidal austerity, where the American people are the targets of brutal, ruthless, primitive accumulation, and the proceeds are sent into the pockets of George Soros, David Rockefeller, Goldman Sachs, and the other Wall Street predators, vultures, and hyenas who own this regime as no other regime in recent memory has been owned. And at the beginning of our consideration of this tawdry document, the inaugural address, I won't call it the first inaugural because I sincerely doubt there'll be a second, but Obama's inaugural address, it's a historical aberration and indeed to some degree a monstrosity. Let us remember the difference between the outgoing Bush regime and the now ensconced in power Obama regime. Structurally, Bush, of course, was to a large degree a puppet of Wall Street himself, as indicated by the presence of Hanky Panky Paulson from Goldman Sachs at the Treasury. However, as a Republican, Bush has also got to keep one eye on the low-wage sweatshop employers, the anti-union characters, in particular the southern states where the Republican Party continues to exist. That's one structural point. Obama is 1,000% Wall Street. The only difference is whether certain executive departments are owned by one investment bank or another. Obama, of course, owned by Trilateral Commission, Rockefeller, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank. Biden, owned by MBNA Credit Card Bank. Then we've got Daschle, big power in the new regime, the senator from Citibank. We've got Donovan, the new Secretary of Housing. He's owned by Prudential Mortgage Bankers. We've got Arne Duncan, owned by the foundations, the Ford, the Rockefeller, the Annenberg, the Gates, the Broad, and so forth. So you can go through this new regime and see which Wall Street complex of interests owns which cabinet officer. But in general, the big difference is this. Bush was a brutal thug and reactionary, and he flaunted it. This was a very direct, cynical expression of imperialist brutality. Things like, bring it on, wanted dead or alive, right? Bush was a killer. He made no secret of the fact that he was a killer. He wanted to tap your phone. He wanted to snoop in your public library records and all the rest of this stuff. So at least, as Bush said, you may hate me, but you know exactly where I stand. Yes, indeed. You were a brutal reactionary thug and, of course, an incompetent bungler, but we don't need to get into this. The difference with Obama is the following. This is the main difference in understanding the new regime. We are now in the area of deception. Obama is a shifty, slimy, slippery, professional manipulator. The watchwords here are deception, trickery, hypocrisy, lying, sleight of hand, duping people. Obama, remember, is the anthropologist's son who has conducted himself all of his life like an anthropologist doing field work among the savages. He's not exactly among the Paleolithic or Neolithic cave dwellers or village dwellers, but he's now here in the United States where he is bemused by the presence of so many bitter clingers, people who react to the destruction of their jobs by clinging to guns, religion, and anti-free trade, most interesting of all, the one the Republicans seem to have forgotten about. That is Obama. It's a deception regime. It's based on lying. That is why I called it the day of the dupes. In particular, the left liberals are continuing to address their pathetic little missives to the little father Barkey and all the pent-up hopes and aspirations of the long reactionary nightmare of Bush are now being sent to Obama with little letters, the same sort of thing these people might have been sending to the Santa Claus, not so many decades or maybe quite a few decades before. This is pathetic. To beg and to prostrate yourself before Barkey is degrading. It's pathetic. It's futile. It's a waste of time. It actually cripples an opposition. It's time to move into a stance of opposition. Most important, we need a left opposition. There is some kind of right opposition, but it's intellectually and morally bankrupt. It's largely based on those low-wage sweatshop employers in the South and the congressional people that they own and foreign automobile companies who are interested in union busting. That's the opposition you see so far. The urgent thing is to build a New Deal or moderate left, reasonable left New Deal opposition to the Barkey Obama right-wing neoliberal tinged with neo-fascism regime. That's the task. And therefore, it's time to stop sending letters to Barkey. It's time to stop the infinite pathos of appealing to Barkey for 9/11 truth or an end to the wars or anything of this sort. Just to clear the air, remember that Obama was the first to demand reckless unilateral bombing of Northwest Pakistan. He pioneered the policy. He demanded it in Chicago at the end of July 2007 in that debate, I believe, at Soldiers Field. At that point, Mrs. Clinton said, no, that's too much. McCain said, that's too much. Even Bush said, that's too much. But through the coup d'etat of the Principals Committee, of Gates, Rice, Paulson, and Mullen, with Brzezinski in the background, the use of predator drones to kill Pakistanis, Paki bashing on the largest scale, open season on Pakistanis in their own country. You see a wedding party, you bomb it. You see a peaceful village, you bomb it. Because the goal is to destroy the country. Predator drone attacks under the Barkey Obama regime have now killed 17 Pakistanis, 17 dead human beings, dead under the Barkey Obama regime. Mr. Obama, President Obama, stop these attacks. Well, it's pathetic. If you want to stop them, you better mobilize and denounce them and end the reign of illusion. La Grande Illusion must come to an end in Washington. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, the theme of the inaugural The Day of the Dupes and the speech of Malaise in the wretched, discredited tradition of Jimmy Carter. The new Carter, but 10 times worse, 100 times worse, infinitely worse under the conditions of breakdown crisis that we now have. So it was the day of the dupes, a day prepared by deception, by lying, by trickery, by false promises. And of course, the left liberals are eager to be duped. Their whole lives is going lurching from one market of dupes to the next. Let's just go back and remember that day about 30 years ago when Carter was inaugurated. And it turns out that Carter, in his memoirs, basically tells us that his inaugural address was a tissue of lies, and he knew it at the time, that he was in the process of duping the American public. And here's Carter writing a decade or more after the fact, talking about how he felt when he gave his inaugural address. And I quote from former President Jimmy Carter, "Watching the sea of approving faces on Inauguration Day, I wondered how few of the happy celebrants would agree with my words if they analyzed them closely. At the time, it was not possible even for me to imagine the limits we would have to face. And in some ways, dealing with limits would become the subliminal theme of the next 4 years and affect the outcome of the 1980 election." Well, Carter's speech, written by Chris Matthews, speechwriter to Carter, James Fallows, currently at The Atlantic, speechwriter to Carter, was, of course, a preparation for the Malthusian campaign of the Trilateral Commission, with Zbigniew Brzezinski and Paul Volcker acting as the in-house controllers for the Carter administration, along with a whole slew of other trilateral people, starting with Carter, Mondale, Vance, and going on down, Blumenthal at the Treasury. Remember, as one interesting writer, and I'm quoting here from my own book, this is Obama, the Postmodern Coup, which right now is about 110 on the Japanese Amazon bestseller list, going very strongly in Japan right now. Get your copy at Amazon here in the U.S., Obama, the Postmodern Coup, the making of the Manchurian candidate. Americans remain a people of the Enlightenment, and I that's a compliment, the Leibnizian Enlightenment. This country is, if it's going to be anything, a vehicle for the scientific and cultural and historical optimism of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the inspiration for the Winthrops, for Franklin, and for many others. Americans remain a people of the Enlightenment who find it hard to accept the postmodern view or the ancient view of a world of limited possibilities, and we should not. There is no reason to accept this view. Finance capital may be dying, but humanity does not have to die. In particular, Anglo-American finance capital demonstrably is dying, but we don't have to go down with them. So what we obviously need is a resurgence of scientific optimism, scientific, technological, and industrial optimism. And this is exactly what synthetic candidates like Carter and Obama are designed to sabotage. And we have in one of the studies of Carter, the administration is summed up. Carter preached to us constantly about sacrifice and limitations, which none of us wanted to hear. Well, that's what you're getting now from Barack Obama. And I was telling you this as much as a year ago. It's a day of the dupes. It's a day of deception. Now, let's begin to look here at the inaugural address. Let's start, first of all, from the demagogic literary point of view. This, of course, is a literary document. It has pretensions. You've got to imagine that it's written by Jon Favreau, the scurrilous young thug, the wordsmith. The little Goebbels, the mini Goebbels of the Obama regime, tells us that he's been sitting in Starbucks coffee houses, the ones that haven't closed because of the Depression, sitting there with his computer and tapping away one page a day. Now, this speech could hardly, at a literary level, could hardly have been more banal and more mediocre. This is amazing. With Kennedy, of course, you had Theodore Sorensen, who had gone back to the speeches of Pericles, back in the Athenian Renaissance, but I don't think Favreau was able to do it. Poor Favreau, tapping away in his Starbucks coffee house, comes up with a speech which is, first of all, a tissue of the flattest, most discredited, most banal cliches, trite, hackneyed, in the recent history of the presidency, as far as I can see. Think about cliches, right? Think about the things that you're supposed to avoid when you're writing. From Obama, we hear about rising tides, gathering clouds, raging storms, nagging fears, dark chapters, watchful eyes, dying campfires, icy currents. We have bitter swill, a warming planet, fallen heroes, hungry minds, the wrong side of history. We're supposed to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off. That's even a song. So a tissue, a mosaic of the stupidest, dumbest cliches. These cliches would make a Republican wince. Even an illiterate like Bush probably had fewer cliches in his speech. He was able to coin phrases like compassionate conservatism. Nobody had ever heard that one before. So that is the literary garb of this. Boring, droning, and above all, it's a document of contempt. It is an attack on the American people. As George Will, alias the Shill, right, from Hollinger Corporation, says, in Barack Obama's inaugural address, he delicately implied that the American people do not just have a problem, they are a problem. And in particular, the Messiah talks to us, assuming his God, St. Paul, saying it's time to set aside childish things. What childish things? Politics? The frank clash of interests over real political and economic divergences? Is that childish, Barky? Is that what you're telling us? That parliamentary democracy, in other words, is childish? Or the desire for a better standard of living? Is that childish, Barky? Well, that seems to be the idea. Now, just to get it clear right off the bat, a couple of columnists have understood what the heart of the matter was. We are being told here that we collectively have collective guilt, and I quote, the economic crisis, let's give it to you straight from Obama here, we've got an economic crisis. Our economy is badly weakened, and we'll get to this in just a second. You'll find out why you're responsible. Not Wall Street, not Goldman Sachs, not Bear Stearns, not Lehman Brothers, but you. You did it. World Crisis Radio and our special in-depth analysis of Barky's inaugural address, a tissue of cliches delivered in the spirit of Malaise and of Jimmy Carter on the Day of the Dupes, January 20th, 2009. Of course, speech is all written by Jon Favreau. We should have mentioned, you know, with the Carter administration, we had to wait a couple of years before Hamilton Jordan molested the wife of the Egyptian ambassador, telling her that he wanted to see the pyramids. In the case of Favreau, he started molesting a cardboard cutout of Senator Clinton when he was in his cups before. This is probably the spirit in which he was writing this speech. If you look at the performance by Jay-Z, the scurrilous, vile, racist rapper, apparently one of the resident setters of the trend, right? Kennedy had Pablo Casals, and Obama has Jay-Z, the rapper. You're dealing here with the most scurrilous administration. And right off the bat, even before they came in, so this is now Favreau writing this stuff. Let's go back. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some. I mean, that's Wall Street, but he won't say so. But also, our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. Wait a minute. Our collective failure? There's 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives, Barky, and the average person had absolutely nothing to do with this except as a victim. This is an insinuation of collectivism, collective guilt, and indeed communitarianism, somehow that class struggle has ended and that we're all in the same boat. Well, we're not in the same boat. We're not in the same boat with Thane of Merrill Lynch and his $15,000 commode and his $90,000 rug. We have nothing in common. So we reject your premise that there's our collective failure. Don't tell us about our collective failure, Balky. We'll contrast, if we have time later, this kind of nonsense with the actual Franklin D. Roosevelt 1933 inaugural address, and you'll see the difference. And this question of the New Age. The New Age comes up at least twice, and maybe three times in this. We're being told that we're in a New Age. Not good. Homes have been lost. Jobs shed. Businesses shuttered. Our health care is too costly. Wait a minute. What's the problem with our health care? That it's too costly? No, that's not the problem. The problem is that 50 million people don't have it, Barkey. This is the financier point of view. This is the foundation point of view. This is what I've been telling you all along. So our health care is too costly. Our schools fail too many. Wait a minute. Slums destroy people, Barkey, not schools. Balky's getting ready to blame the teachers' union, to bust the teachers' union for the fact that millions of people live in abject poverty in the inner cities with infant mortality, high rates of incarceration, despair, malnutrition, drugs, gang violence, lack of jobs, lack of transport, lack of housing, lack of everything. But he says our schools fail too many. If I were in the American Federation of Teachers, boy, if I were Ronnie Weingarten, I would watch out, because Arnie Duncan is coming after you now with his wing person, Michelle Rhee, and then his other wing, Joel Klein, up there in New York, and they're going to bust the American Federation of Teachers as a prelude to destroy all kinds of public sector union activity. Each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. Well, global warming was a hard sell that day because it was freezing. Everybody was chattering. Their teeth were chattering. We're told that the way we use energy threatens our planet. Later on in the speech, we're told that we have to work tirelessly to roll back the specter of a warming planet. He went as fast as he could on that one. He couldn't say, let me take 5 or 10 minutes now and talk to you about global warming. And the people out there saying, wait a minute, we're freezing, Barkey. Get to it. Get to the end of it. The specter of a warming planet. Well, the specter of the sunspot cycle, I guess, is what we're talking about. And then we get back to the beginning. The exordium, as it's called in Quintilian's rhetoric. We have a nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable and the next generation must lower its sights. That's the end of the first part. Now, that's pure Carter malaise. In other words, historical pessimism and cultural pessimism. Now, obviously, there may well be a decline, but not in the way that he means. And if you don't want to have the decline, all you need to do is dump the financier ruling class and cut their power, and you will be okay. Today I say to you that the challenges we face are real. Remember Carter, Malaise speech. The energy crisis is real. Well, this is we're being told the same thing. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. Wait a minute. We come to proclaim an end to petty grievances? In other words, interest group politics, right? The fact that Balky thinks it's a scandal that various groups come and lobby for their economic interests. So there's obviously a problem with that system that the average person, the public interest, is getting short shrift. But how is he going to proclaim an end to that? This, again, is anti-parliamentary rhetoric. Indeed, it's fascistoid, in the sense that the promise here is that class struggle, which of course is petty and childish, will come to an end. Now let's go a little bit further. We are told, of course, we get back to this theme, that the difficult choices have been dodged. Our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Protecting narrow interests? Does that mean the interest of the UAW, of the American Federation of Teachers, of retirees, of women, of the black ghetto? Or does it mean Wall Street? Because we've got Barkey making phone calls for the second round of the TARP. $350 billion for who? The Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America. I call those narrow interests, Barkey. I think when Obama says narrow interests, he means groups within the population. As you can read in my book, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, the notion that a trade union is one of the special interests that have got to be fought was inaugurated by trilateral commission man Walter Mondale in 1984. This is the vice president of Jimmy Carter. And this, of course, corresponds to the destruction of the Democratic Party as we knew it. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin to, again, the work of remaking America. Well, the cliches, of course, are overwhelming, but you get the idea. What are we going to do? We will restore science to its rightful place. Well, I've already explained global warming and the anthropogenic version, man-created, humanly created global warming, is simply the new version of Nazi race science. It is a completely irrational proposition which admits of no empirical confirmation or refutation either way. If you talk to a climatologist, i.e. a charlatan, the climatologist whose stock in trade is to push this stuff will not allow you to select any data series in the real world that would refute the idea of human-created global warming, and therefore you're basically stuck with it. It's an article of faith. It's a fanatical thesis of Malthusianism. Therefore, you're not restoring science to your place. You're simply knocking off one discredited doctrine and bringing in another. And we'll do a critique of Darwin sometime soon from a Leibnizian least action point of view, not from an obscurantist point of view. So we will restore science to its rightful place, wield technology's wonders, of course, not nuclear energy. We'll have windmills and solar cells, but not nuclear and not thermonuclear, to raise healthcare's quality and lower its costs. And how about the 50 million, Barkey? How about all those people who don't have any? Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. To World Crisis Radio and our in-depth review of the Malaise speech, Carter's second inaugural, given on the Day of the Dupes in Washington, January 20th, 2009, by the most thoroughly puppetized president since Jimmy Carter, and that would be Barkey, President Barkey, now in command. And notice at the moment of the seizure of power, the Machtergreifung, having seized power, the mask drops to some extent, and the soaring utopian messianic rhetoric turns into the flat, banal platitudes of austerity, sacrifice, responsibility, and he's going to come and break your union and take your pension away. He'll take away your Social Security pension and your Medicare, and he'll leave you nothing but your eyes to cry with, because George Soros and David Rockefeller and Goldman Sachs need that money, and you share collective responsibility for the failure to make the hard decisions. You should have been driving down your own standard of living, not two-thirds, not minus two-thirds, from 1967 or 66 when it peaked. You should have been giving up more, especially after 9/11. That was Bush's mistake, that he didn't demand that you give up more for Wall Street, as David Broder has written. So we'll harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. So we're committed to the full radical ecological environmentalist wacko, radical Malthusian energy program. We will transform our schools, bust the union, and colleges and universities, you know, a lot of them are gone because their endowments have been destroyed in the crash, to meet the demands of a new age. And there it is again, that Freemasonic New World Order code word of the new age. What he seems to mean by this, by the way, is the age of scarcity. If we look at the recent inaugural addresses, let's take President Nicolas Sarkozy of France. In his inaugural address, or equivalent thereof, he said, we are now in an age of scarcity. Well, why are we in an age of scarcity? Why should we be? Well, it's the 1.5 quadrillion derivatives. Of course, if you got rid of them, you could then restart the economy by making available cheap public credit for production, and you'd begin to produce your way out of the age of scarcity. But that is not what these bankers' boys have in mind. To return to Barkey, what the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted under them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. And again, this is the messianic utopian version of the end of class struggle, the end of the clash of interests in the legislative branch. Now, Barkey promises austerity. We don't ask whether government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families to find jobs at decent wages, health care they can afford, or care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will be cut. Programs will be cut means the equivalent of a line item veto, which he does not have, coming from this Killifer. Now, of course, he might assert a line item veto, and now the rubber stamp Democratic Party swooning, gurgling, drooling congressional forces might allow him to simply arrogate to himself a line item veto in the way that he's done this on some of the other scores. This is Killifer, right? Killifer the knife. Killifer is his performance queen, and she's going to be there evaluating the entire federal budget line by line. Recall, says Barkey, that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism. I take this to be an attempt to distance himself from both, since he's been accused of being both, and I would essentially put him in the same league with the young Benito Mussolini, the founder of fascism, back in 1919 to 1925, and indeed after 1922. Further from Barkey, remember the issue of the war is what he brought, what he rode into power. The questions about Afghanistan and Iraq, above all Iraq. He talks about this in one sentence. This was spoken trippingly off the tongue by Barkey. Couldn't get away from this fast enough. We'll begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. Now, what this means is endless occupation and endless war in Iraq. He's way, way off his 16-month program. He's up to 36 months, I think, is the best estimate I can do. And a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. Well, he's going to escalate Afghanistan with 30,000 troops, and a lot of them will not come back. We'll talk about Afghanistan in just a minute. We got a good report from a German expert who had been a back channel for the Taliban and the need for Karzai to the Obama team, who had come up with it. They all approved a peace plan they wanted to submit to Obama. Obama has rejected it. Obama has rejected, out of hand, brusquely, off the table, get lost, go home, scram, peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we'll work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. And again, he had to get that one over as fast as he could because everybody was freezing. You're going to have, you know, frostbite at the global warming conference. We know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. Now notice, when he thinks of the United States, he does not look at this as the manifestation of ideas, far from it. He is a blood and soil realist. He is a Völkischer realist in the sense that he believes that blood, ethnic identity, is what makes you. What he means by patchwork is a transformation, not the melting pot anymore, where an amalgam emerges, but now it's a patchwork of a mosaic where the various components maintain their cultural identity, indeed expand and increase their cultural identity, because that's the foundation policy for keeping the American people weak, impotent, divided, fractured, fragmented, and at war with itself. So he's got Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, non-believers, language, culture, ends of the earth. But wait a minute, the ideas of 1776, the ideas of 1787, the ideas of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are in many ways the distillation of the entire Italian Renaissance, European Enlightenment, Leibnizian scientific upswing of that period. It's not a patchwork. It is the most advanced scientific concepts available at that time, most of them still valid today. But Barkey thinks, there's no other way to put it, thinks like a national socialist. Remember, this is the president who described himself a couple of days after being elected, talked about a mutt like me, a mutt like me. Well, the mongrelization of the races was a feature of eugenics leading into national socialism. And Barkey seems to think in these terms. He believes in ethnic racial identity, and this is how he sees the world. So therefore, it's a patchwork. We have a mongrel nation, I guess. We're all a bunch of mutts. But why look at it this way? What is the point of this? Precisely, the foundations want you to think of yourself in this way. And now, at the end of this section, to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. For the world has changed, and we must change with it. More cliches, but you get the idea. Actually, when he says we can't be indifferent to the suffering of the world, well, who's been doing that? I think David Rockefeller, George Soros, and all the people who have the money to do something about it have shown the most hard-hearted, rock-like granite indifference. But what he means by this is he's going to have solidarity for third world development, solidarity tax for third world development, the dirty secret being that that will go to pay debt service on debt that these countries owe. If he were serious, he would say, I'm declaring a unilateral U.S. moratorium and debt cancellation on all international financial debt of all countries below a certain standard of living. Most of sub-Saharan Africa, most of South Asia would get a comprehensive debt moratorium. But you didn't hear that. He's getting ready to tax you, so Soros gets his debt service.